Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we discuss media literacy education. Our guests are professor and author Julie Frechette from ACME, the Action Coalition for Media Education. We're also joined by author and professor Bill Usman, who is director of the new Media Literacy and Digital Culture Graduate Program at Sacred Heart University in Connecticut. So today on the Project Censored Show, Media Literacy Education for the Hour. Please stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we focus for the hour on media literacy. And specifically, we're going to be looking at a joint program and project between Project Censored, ACME, the Action Coalition for Media Education, and also a new Master of Arts in Media Literacy and Digital Culture program at Sacred Heart University in Connecticut. So we're joined right now by a professor, Julie Frechette, and Julie is chair of the Department of Communication at Worcester State University in Massachusetts. She teaches courses on media studies, critical cultural studies, media education, and gender representation. She's co-editor of the book Media Education for a Digital Generation. This is a new book, and in fact, it has a piece in it by Associate Director of Project Censored, Andy Lee Roth, on media frames. So, Julie, thanks so much for joining the show today.
It's my pleasure.
We're also joined on the phone by Bill Usman. He is co-media literacy officer of the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, and he is a director of the Media Literacy and Digital Culture Graduate Program at Sacred Heart University. His research focuses on media, race, ideology, and popular culture, and the representation of incarceration on television. So again, today for the program, we're going to be talking about all things media literacy. Bill Usman, thanks so much for joining the show today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Mickey.
Julie, let's go to you. Tell us a little bit about ACME, the Action Coalition for Media Education. ACME's been around for quite a while, but you, along with Rob Williams, have sort of restarted ACME, and you're working on really getting the program up and running in terms of media literacy. Tell us about ACME and what's going on.
Absolutely. ACME is just a fantastic organization because it's built through a coalition of people who are dedicated to trying to implement media literacy. Now, if I were to explain what that is to you, I would tell you that it's an educational approach, and its goal is to give media users as much freedom and choice by learning how to best access, analyze, evaluate, and produce media in all different venues, platforms, and such. So here we are now in the digital age, and so media literacy education is more relevant now than ever. So as we've made that shift from analog to digital, and young people are tethered to their digital devices, and certainly adults are as well too, it's really vital for us to work together with folks who are committed to teaching people how to be critical and active users of media in ways that really enhance not just using these for fun, but for democratic means, social justice means.
Julie, this is Peter Phillips. What does it mean to be media critical? We know that there are six major media corporations now that dominate 90% of the media in the country. Young people under 30 are not reading newspapers. So what are we teaching here? What are we trying to get young people to do?
Well, it's about going beyond just using technology for its own sake, but using it for the needs, the humanistic needs, the democratic needs, social justice needs that we have. So we're very used to things being sort of top-down when it comes to mainstream media. We have a limited menu option. But in the digital age, now everybody has these tools, but we're not always using them for the means in which, you know, we'd like to use them to, you know, make certain causes known, to create coalitions, to speak truth to power, to analyze abuses of power. Those kinds of things that we've been seeing happen at a national and international level are really exciting. So media literacy education is really about teaching critical approaches to understanding who's producing the technology How can we leverage those tools for things other than just producing cheap for them to capitalize off of? And in what ways can that be really transformative and achieve the goals that we have as social human beings rather than capitalistic goals that tend to be what the media use these tools for?
So, Bill Usman, let's go to you. You, along with your colleague Lori Bindig, you have this program. It's the Media Literacy and Digital Culture Graduate Program at Sacred Heart University. It's in the Media Studies Department. This is a graduate program. This is pretty advanced study in what Julie was just talking about in terms of media literacy. So talk to us a little bit about how this program came about and what you're hoping to achieve.
Well, the real impetus for the program actually started before I got to Sacred Heart. And Dr. Bindig and her colleagues in the School of Communication and Media Arts, they looked around at what they were doing on the undergrad level, which really was a media literacy approach to understanding the media environment, learning how to be an active participant in the media environment in a productive way, in a democratic way, in a way focused on issues of social justice, all of the stuff that Julie just mentioned. And it kind of occurred to them that they were working with lots of students who would want to pursue this on a higher level as they went searching for graduate degrees. There are thousands of students around the country and internationally who take courses in media studies who, you know, some of the things they learn in those courses about the concentration of media ownership, the narrowing of discourse, the narrowing of debate, the problems with representation of people of color and women and people of diverse sexualities. These are, you know, issues that become really, really important to many students. And then they're not quite sure, you know, after they get a BA, well then, you know, where do they go? What do they do with this? So the idea was to create this media literacy graduate program that would help to prepare students for, you know, possibly going on to PhDs in order, you know, to really become researchers and teachers, but also for people who might want to be educators, people who want to work in nonprofit organizations where media issues are so central to getting out the message of their concern. And, you know, so often, as you folks at Project Censored know, when it's a social justice issue, when it's a social movement or social activism, the way they're represented in the mainstream media is just despicable. And so to have people in these organizations who have a high degree of media literacy and can really create a strategic plan for how they're going to get their message across in the media, we thought would be a really important possibility for students to explore. So that was really the goal behind the creation of the program. And as we looked around the country, we saw that there are, you know, a number of master's and PhD programs in media studies, and even a couple that deal with issues of information literacy, but nothing that really dealt with critical media literacy. And, you know, Peter posed to Julie this question of this term critical, and that's really, I think, what distinguishes our new program at Sacred Heart, that it's a degree in critical media literacy, meaning we're not afraid to take on questions of power. We're not afraid to take on questions of representation, of politics, and to look at structural issues of media, look at issues of media ownership, look at the agendas of the corporate media in an unflinching kind of way.
Bill, this sounds very important. And one aspect that Project Censored now for 40-some years is looking at is, of course, censorship and media as propaganda, corporate media as top-down. The social media, however, offers people the opportunity to share, to do media from the bottom up, to be engaged. So we've been thinking along the lines with Sacred Heart and with Action Coalition for Media Education, along this new lines, the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, which is broad-based understanding of trying to get young people in campuses all over the country to engage in critical media analysis. How will your program help expand that?
Well, that's a great question, Peter, and I was really delighted to be given the invitation for, you know, our program to become a part of this Global Critical Media Literacy Project because it fits so well with our mission. You know, our program is called Graduate Program in Media Literacy and Digital Culture. And you're absolutely right when you say the media system today is not the same media system as it was 30 years ago or even 20 or even 10 years ago. There are now possibilities out there for activists, for people who work on projects like Project Censored, to have a more active role and to have a stronger voice. But that potential, the potential that the technology provides, is going to be completely unrealized if we just let companies like Google and Facebook control the digital media environment. There's so much more that can be done with digital media than just taking pictures of your food and posting them so that all your friends can see what you had for lunch. But the Facebook model is to really turn people into free labor for their corporation. You know, every time I post to my friends, that gives them an opportunity to more effectively reach people with their advertising. And the goal in our program is to really help students realize the potential of digital media and to see how digital media can be turned to democratic purposes rather than simply corporate purposes.
That's the voice of Bill Usman. He's a professor and director of Media Literacy and Digital Culture at Sacred Heart University in Connecticut. And Julie Frechette, I want to bring you back in here. I think you were wanting to interject in the conversation here. You're chair of the Department of Communication at Worcester State University in Massachusetts. And go ahead, you were wanting to say something.
Sure. Well, I was going to add that the Action Coalition for Media Education supports a very similar style of smart media education that's critical that Bill was talking about and that Peter was inquiring about. So, for example, if you then apply what is critical media literacy as it relates to digital skills today that are so relevant, well, then you might ask certain questions like, how are young people creating a sense of self-realization and self-esteem through what's called content curation? So how are they using photos, videos, and text and audio and other media to do those things effectively? Well, if you go back to Bill's point and you just let them do these things for fun or to play and produce content so that it can be profitable for other companies like Google and Facebook, well, that's not really critical media literacy. But if you teach skills that teach young people how to curate content so that it brings forth issues of who is marginalized in the culture, whose ideas and voices tend to be underrepresented, what kinds of things aren't being told in mainstream media narratives that could be effectively told when all sorts of diverse people are able to be those content curators using tools that are relatively inexpensive now. So I think that's very important, as well as to help then teach them to connect with others socioculturally, right, to define their sense of communal connections. And that can be at the local level, regional, it can go from national to global. But I think it's important for educators and programs like the one at Sacred Heart University to teach young people and students how to use digital tools and social media platforms to foster effective interaction and what's known as affinity spaces for people who otherwise get marginalized in the culture to come together. And then, of course, for activism and global citizenship. So I think this is really important in light of the fact that you do have a lot more grassroots activity, a lot of groundswell activity where people are already producing, but you want to take them one step further so that they produce it for their own needs as they see, you know, their involvement in society.
And if I could just build on what Julie just said there, Mickey and Peter, you take the Black Lives Matter movement as an example. Here's a group that is literally being framed as a terrorist organization by the mainstream media. Literally. Like, these are the terms that have been used to describe them. This is an organization that cannot depend upon the corporate media to represent their point of view, their perspective in any type of ethical way. So it then becomes pertinent that they take on the means of production for themselves and that they utilize the capabilities of digital media in order to control their message instead of have it be distorted by the likes of Fox News and the others.
Bill Usman and Julie Frechette, let's apply some of what we're talking about here to corporate media events. The historian Daniel Boorstin wrote in 1962 a book called The Image, A Guide to Pseudo-Events one of the examples that was in there was the press conference, the staged managed political theater, essentially, right, that media basically frames and transmits. And we've been seeing here so-called presidential debates, Republican and Democratic parties, obviously two parties supported by major corporations, including the corporate news media. And in the Democratic debate, CNN, their parent company, Time Warner, is one of the top five contributors to Hillary Clinton's campaign. None of this ever seems to come out. So none of this pulling back the curtain and seeing what's going on with these media organizations that are showing these things. And in the way in which they frame the debates, frame the questions, cast the candidates, really, this is a ripe, real-time kind of assignment, like a civic assignment, right? Like the classroom of the real world. And this is the kind of thing that I certainly know that we do at Project Censored, and I know that you all do. But what are some of your comments in terms of applying media literacy? Let's go with you first, Julie. One of your earlier books, Developing Media Literacy in Cyberspace. Let's comment on sort of like what we see in the corporate news media versus what we are seeing in social media about what's happening in American politics, principally in these debates.
Well, you know, Mickey, I think that's such a relevant and timely question. And I think when we were concerned in writing first about the internet developing, we used to call it cyberspace as my first book referred to it, but it was really an evolving time in which academics, researchers, and people who were interested in education were using the internet to exchange their own pertinent studies and were looking to share knowledge in very innovative ways that they hadn't been able to before. And so the mainstream media, of course, leaves a lot of people out. And as you noted, there are very few large corporations that are transnational that control the framing of how issues are presented. Now we have a situation where with digital media tools, and specifically with social media, people can then tweet and respond even in real time during the debates about what they're noticing is missing, what they're noticing isn't being covered. So you're absolutely right that the mainstream works so hard to create this very polished and limited kind of debate, and yet you saw even Bernie Sanders was tweeting during the Republican debates that so many issues of relevance to the average citizen were being left out. And so I think people now, through these tools, are having new platforms and vehicles and venues through which to talk back to the media. And I know when we think about approaches that are effective, I've always done something with my students around these national debates where I ask the students to come up with their top 10 issues that affect them and their communities. And then they contrast them with whether or not the media are doing a good version or a good job at addressing these issues. And I think when they see the contrast between the issues that are the most salient for them and their generation, and they contrast it with this level of having more sound bites and people being judged on what kind of clever sound bites they came up with and who won and using like a horse race style and polling information to determine who's the victor and the winner and who had the best one-liner, that's not really what they're interested in. So I think if we can incorporate those kinds of strategies, those critical media literacy strategies, into different learning environments, whether it's at the master's degree level, the community level, or K-12 and higher ed in general, that's what we need more of, so that people learn to assess their own realities and juxtapose them with the framed reality that the media works so hard to create.
And Mickey, you know, to call out to your question about what's happening with this, you know, right now, right in this moment, you know, everything that Julie says is so relevant to understanding this. And if I could just offer one example, I think many people would agree that the biggest issue that we're facing as a culture, as a society, as a planet right now is the issue of climate change. Here's something that happened in the Democratic debate. There was this little exchange that happened between Martin O'Malley and Anderson Cooper, who was moderating the debate. After O'Malley brought up something about a green revolution in energy, this is what Anderson Cooper had to say, and I'm reading this directly from the transcript. We'll talk more about environmental change and climate issues coming up. Some of the candidates have tried marijuana, as has probably everybody else in the room. Does it influence their views on legalization? So, you know, they tried to introduce a question of climate change, and this immediately gets turned to whether the people participating in the debate have tried marijuana or not. I think that's a classic example of what's not getting covered in the mainstream media and why we need groups like Project Censored, why we need groups like ACME, why we need the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, why we need the MLDC Project at CHU, because this absence in the mainstream media, something that you guys at Project Censored have been tracking since, you know, the 1970s.
We're speaking with Professor Bill Usman. He is director of Media Literacy and Digital Culture Graduate Program at Sacred Heart University. We are also joined by Julie Frechette. She is chair of Department of Communications at Worcester State University in Massachusetts. And we're talking today about media literacy and media literacy education. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We will continue our conversation and we'll talk a little bit more specifically about this Global Critical Media Literacy Project, this joint effort between these several organizations, after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today on the Project Censored Show, we're talking about media literacy and media literacy education. And we're joined by two guests, experts in the field of media literacy. And we're delighted to have Professor Julie Frechette on with us. She's chair of Department of Communication, Worcester State University in Massachusetts, co-editor with Rob Williams of the book Media Education for a Digital Generation. It's on Routledge. It's out next year, right, Julie? Or is it out?
It is out.
Okay, so it's out this fall, right? And also, we are joined by the director of Media Literacy and Digital Culture Graduate Program at Sacred Heart University, Professor Bill Usman. When we left off, we were mentioning this joint effort, right, between ACME, which is the Action Coalition for Media Education, between Sacred Heart's graduate program in Media Literacy and Digital Culture and Project Censored and Media Freedom Foundation. This is called the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, and our board member, Nolan Higdon, who works with us at Project Censored, is also on the board at ACME. He is a coordinator of the GCMLP, as it's called. All of us are in the general field of media literacy, media education. We all have our own sort of angles, certainly Project Censored, the news that doesn't make the news, ACME doing historically a lot of media literacy issues, K-12. Now we have this new graduate program on media literacy. So it's really this GCMLP, Global Critical Media Literacy Project, is the confluence, right, of all of our efforts. And Julie Frechette, let's go to you and talk a little more specifically. We have actually this new packet, right, this new booklet. It's an educator's resource guide. And if people are interested in learning about it, if educators particularly are interested in seeing this packet, they could email us, or you can go to the projectcensored.org website. You can go to the ACME site, which is smartmediaeducation.net. Is that right, Julie?
That is correct.
And Bill Usman, you have a website too. It's Sacred Heart. Is it sacredheart.edu?
/MLDC.
Okay, so you can contact any of us at these three places, and if you're an educator, we would share a PDF packet, right, so you can review this media resource guide. But we were mentioning before the civic classroom, and we're also all professors. So let's talk about what are some ways we do these things in the classroom. And Julie, let's go to you and ask, what are you doing in the classroom specifically that brings the real world in and, you know, helps develop media literacy skills in a meaningful way?
Well, there are lots of ways in which we do this, and media literacy is fantastic for asking people to bring their own experiences, their own worldviews into the classroom and to juxtapose them with what they see in the mainstream media and in other sources and venues and platforms. Now, I do want to talk about changes in the digital age that have really enhanced how we teach in the classroom, because now we can conjure up very easily at any time alternative media, and it's not uncommon for me to use those sources now and to tap into educational documentaries and even go to what, you know, used to be the Jon Stewart Show. I used to bring those in to show students how to deconstruct the media in effective ways. So we would take contemporary narratives, current events, and look at them through a critical eye, and then take them apart and look at these narratives and then say, why is it that the media are so consistently not addressing these particular issues? And this is aligned with Project Censored and their attention to looking at the most underreported, underrepresented stories that have the most global impact. We like to do the same kinds of things with the Action Coalition for Media Education, and the Global Critical Media Literacy Project is a fantastic way to bring together and unify the visions of our organizations and help to create an alternative to the current media structure. And that means teaching students to, A, first understand what that structure is, because for many of them it's invisible. They're fish in water. And they don't think about who owns the various channels that are out there. So it's the whole, you know, Bruce Springsteen song about 500 channels, but nothing's on. They're surrounded by media, but they're not often reflective or encouraged to be aware of where their media is coming from. So, of course, looking at Rupert Murdoch is always something fun to do in the classroom, especially in light of the debacle that happened just a few years ago with tapping into people's wireless phones and working with the police to extract personal data and information illegally. When that was exposed, I think students really understood in the digital age just how easy it is for powerful figures and people to then work with and use very personal information for exploitative means to make a profit. So I'd also like to address something that Douglas Rushkoff has written about, and we use his perspective. He writes the foreword for our Media Education for a Digital Generation book. And he talks about how in the digital age and in a digital environment, we are no longer just the audience, but we are the programmers. And that means that at least now we're producing content. But with that comes the added responsibility of being ethical content producers, of being aware of how to use these things effectively to tell different stories that are underrepresented, and to talk back to those structures that exist that perhaps are not aligned with our goals. So I think it's important to think about the ways in which everyone's producing content in the digital age, and a lot of companies are talking about how this is so revolutionary and exciting. But I think what a critical media literacy approach does is it says, let's look at how Facebook is not a neutral social networking platform any more than Fox News would be considered a neutral television network, as Bill was aptly suggesting earlier. So to understand a technology's biases is really a huge step in understanding content creation, right? So what choices you're using between YouTube, Vimeo, Facebook, Twitter, whatever you're using, these are choices between very different architectures, very different business models, and they have different things that enhance your abilities and that limit them. So to teach students to understand the structural limitations and who's profiting off of the very platforms that they're using is really important. Just as we would want to teach them who owns our TV channels and who's producing a film, they need to understand the architecture of who actually is benefiting from and profiting off of the digital tools and mobile devices that we're using today.
So one of the exercises that I've had students do, Mickey and Peter, is, you know, almost all of our students have Facebook accounts. So I ask them to spend 48 hours liking everything that comes across on their feed. Everything. That's the only ground rule for the exercise. And this isn't original to me. You know, I've picked this up from people. And then after they do that for 48 hours, I ask them to take a look at what happens to their news feed, how it becomes dominated by advertising, how everything that they do is being watched carefully and is being, you know, collected and curated and monetized, and then to write a reflective essay about that. They hate it. They hate doing this, because what it does is it forces them into a reflection on what's really going on behind the scenes when they're posting pictures and communicating with their friends, so-called, but actually what they're really doing is that labor for Facebook that we talked about a little bit earlier.
So, Bill, what you're saying here then is that Facebook, Google searches and all of that are recorded, and that advertising and profit is directed individually to people based upon the content that they're putting out.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's really what it's all about. I mean, let's not make any mistake about this. Like, just as was true with old media, radio, television, these are profit-centered industries. And their goal is not to provide us with some wonderful user experience or some enlightening type of connections to other people. Their goal is to make a profit. And the way that these digital companies do it is they do it through the time that we spend on their sites. The more time that we spend, the more money that they make. Julie mentioned Doug Rushkoff a little earlier. Rushkoff has a pretty great little film called Generation Like, which really gets into this and the way that very, very young people are being exploited by these companies with the promise of some type of connection to the world of celebrities or, you know, some type of social status that they can generate in their own environment, but that the real goal is to be able to track their habits and to really target them with advertising that is meant to appeal to them on a very elemental kind of level.
So, Julie Fichette, let's bring you in on this issue as well. Playing off of Bill Usman there, what are your thoughts?
I want to jump in, too, and I think everything Bill's saying is absolutely true. And to be fair with disclosure, Bill does have a chapter in our book, and several folks do, affiliated with the good work of Project Censored and the Global Critical Media Literacy Project. But Thomas Corrigan writes a piece in a chapter in our book on Who's Tracking Me? And to add to what Bill was saying, it's about making students understand how the surveillance economy is working. And so he has his students do a similar activity where they use a software program called Lightbeam to analyze all the cookies and the ways in which their online tracking and behavior has been monetized and monitored. So that's very important. I would also add that it's really intriguing when you look at this from a socioeconomic standpoint. When you think about how time and energy and people's labor is being colonized in the digital age, studies will suggest and tell you that those who have lower income and are from lower income communities are the ones who are being exploited the most. These devices are not necessarily inexpensive, and data, of course, costs an awful lot on a month-to-month basis, but we're finding that folks who don't have a lot of income are spending an awful lot using these tools and producing things, but not getting a lot by way of some economic reward. And so when you contrast that with what's going on in higher socioeconomic environments, there's a real irony. So we have the movie out now, the Steve Jobs movie is out. Now, a New York Times article in 2004 revealed that Steve Jobs was a low-tech parent, and he's the one, of course, who launched the iPad and so many other digital devices into people's homes. But when he was asked, he stated that he did not expose his kids to the very products that he had launched in millions of families' lives. He said, "We limit how much technology our kids use at home." Now, what's intriguing about this is a pattern, so that when you look at other technology chief executives and other social media CEOs, they have the same restrictions. So they're telling their children, "We're going to limit your screen time. We're going to forbid apps like Snapchat and other social media. We're going to be really strict about parental controls on your devices, and we're going to encourage you to read books and do things that are culturally going to lead you to develop into a strong student and person ultimately." So what does this say about social media and socio and economic differences? Well, it's saying that parenting and different kinds of educational approaches like these are going to lead to different outcomes depending upon what kind of home environment or school environment you're coming from. So that's one reason why media literacy education is so essential in schools, because some people don't have the same sort of emphases outside of school that other children get. So we want to see the ways in which learning outcomes for students are more equitable based on providing these critical digital media literacy skills.
Julie or Bill, what role does service learning play in this?
That's a great question, Peter, because I was just about to talk about that a little bit. You guys asked for what are some concrete ways that we're trying to get students to respond to this environment. We, in the graduate program at CHU, we very much have this approach where we're going to encourage us co-opting the very tools that are meant to just turn us into laborers for them. So, for example, when students start in the MLDC program, they, right from the very first course that they're in, begin creating their own websites. Every student who graduates from the MLDC program graduates with their own website that they've created that focuses on the work that they've accomplished in graduate school, that focuses on their own alternative media production, their own critical analysis of media that can really go with them as a communication tool and as a digital portfolio that they can use in the future. So this is turning them into media creators. And this is turning them into media creators on a very conscious, ethical, and critical sort of way. Then, at the end of the program, all students are responsible for a capstone project. And the capstone project can be a traditional kind of thesis. We do have some students who are interested in going on to get their PhD so they can write a traditional kind of research thesis. But they also have an option with their capstone project to do a service learning project where maybe they're working with a media literacy organization like Project Censored, like ACME, like the Media Education Foundation, which is in Northampton, Massachusetts. Or we also are having students who are going to be working in local area schools, who are going to be working in community organization with children from underserved populations. There's a wide number of things that they can do as part of their capstone projects to create media literacy curriculum, to do media literacy interventions, and to really work with community organizations, with schools, with activist organizations as part of a very well-defined kind of service learning model.
So, Julie Frechette, let's go back to you with the same kind of question about service learning. Mike Nyman in Buffalo actually wrote a piece for us a few years back on the importance of service learning and using Project Censored in the classroom. Julie, talk to us a little bit about how you see service learning as a significant way of teaching media literacy.
I think it's highly valuable for young people today to see the difference they can make within their own communities. And that's part of getting them untethered from their digital devices and getting them to interact with people who, you know, could really benefit from their help and their assistance. Now, if you tap into then all the great skills that young people have with digital media, it doesn't mean they're media literate necessarily. It means they know how to use these tools. But if you provide enough of a framework through teaching courses in critical media literacy, and you teach them the ways in which they can tell alternative stories through alternative framing devices, as you had mentioned earlier, then they can use those skills to help organizations better represent the good work that they're doing in the community. So service learning makes a lot of sense, and I think almost every program in the country at either the undergraduate level or graduate level, and even in high schools, is seeing the value of service learning projects. Now, for media literacy, it's fantastic because every organization now wants to leverage the power of social media, which is much more affordable. They want to leverage that power to get their own messages out there, but they need help figuring out how do they curate the information that they want to share with the public? How do they let people know that they exist? How do they share important issues facing their community in the right platforms and venues so that people will then attend community-based meetings and have a good way to participate democratically? So I think service learning makes a lot of good sense, and I know the Global Critical Media Literacy Project really emphasizes that, and it looks also at having a focus on equity, giving space for different voices to be represented. And so they adopt a critical race theory, looking at gender as well, situating these things within a global model. I think that makes a lot of sense to use service learning to teach those various things and to help underrepresented groups have a voice where they otherwise might not.
That's Julie Frechette, and we're also joined by Bill Usman today on the Project Censored Show. We're talking about media literacy education. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We'll continue that conversation after this brief break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today on the program, we're looking at media literacy education, and we are joined by Julie Frechette. She is a professor, and she's actually chair of communications department at Worcester State University in Massachusetts. We're also joined by Bill Usman. He is the director of the new graduate program in media literacy and digital culture at Sacred Heart University in Connecticut. Julie is also a member of the board of ACME, which is the Action Coalition of Media Education, with Rob Williams, and we are working with ACME at Project Censored. We're working with Bill Usman and Lori Bindig at the Sacred Heart University. And we have this joint project, Global Critical Media Literacy project. And let's just go right to the basics here. It strikes me as odd, and actually sometimes I'm a bit surprised, that even in higher educational institutions, when we teach things, whether it's sociology or history or communications, social justice and the history of social justice is a very significant component of that, civic education. And media literacy, at least to my way of thinking, is intimately connected with issues of social justice and just basic civics. But I don't always see the dots getting connected in some of the higher educational institutions. So, Bill Usman, let's go to you and let's talk about that and talk about why these things really are connected.
Well, in our new graduate program, we actually have two tracks, two concentrations, which I actually see as being very intertwined. The first one is called Children, Health, and Media, and the second one is Social Justice and Media. And social justice is a really key component of our program. We were talking earlier in the show about what is this word critical? You know, there are some versions of media literacy which I would not really call critical media literacy. And I think one of the differences is in a critical media literacy approach, there is an emphasis on issues of social justice and the recognition that in any culture, the media system that you have plays a defining role in the amount of justice that you have in that society. What people know about, what issues they care about, how are people being represented, how are issues of race and class and gender and sexuality being defined for us by the media systems that we inhabit. Someone once said to me, so I can't take credit for this, but I also don't remember who said it, so I can't give credit for it either. But someone once said to me, and I really believe that this is true, no matter what your cause is, maybe it's racial justice, maybe it's income equality, maybe it's fair treatment of transgendered people, maybe it's climate change, maybe it's the peace movement, it doesn't matter what your cause is, that may be your issue, but your first issue always has to be media. Not that that's the main focus of what you're doing, but that's where you start. You have to start with an awareness of the way that media shape the way we see the world, because otherwise you're never going to get your message across. No one's ever going to care about police brutality if they rely only on the reports in the mainstream media. No one's going to care about sexism and misogyny and homophobia if they don't understand the role that media play in promoting those types of destructive ideologies.
It's actually remarkable that you bring that up, because the concept that you're talking about goes back to former FCC Commissioner Nicholas Johnson, who actually wrote the foreword to our new book, Censored 2016, Media Freedom on the Line, popularly quoted by media scholar Robert McChesney. So I wanted to bring that up. Nicholas Johnson had a book called Second Priority. Basically, the same theme that you just riffed on, that McChesney quoted Johnson over and over again. Nick Johnson said, whatever your first issue of concern, media had better be your second, because without change in the media, progress in your primary area is far less likely. So that's great that you actually brought that concept up, because that's a big theme.
And it's probably from Bob McChesney that I actually was first introduced to that concept, but I really believe it's true. So for anyone with a concern for any social justice issue, media should at least be on their radar. And that's really the approach that ACME is taking. That's the approach that Project Censored has always taken, this new global critical media literacy project, and our graduate degree at SHU. Really, you know, we're finally attuned to that.
I would agree wholeheartedly, and I'm going to make some connections to a 5-college summer institute that used to be held every year, and I was the associate director of that project for, I think it was 4 years, and it was a collaborative venture with the University of Massachusetts Amherst and other area colleges, and we invited 1 year Len Masterman to come in, and he's considered the father of media literacy because he really brought a lot of good pedagogical strategies to how to do this in the classroom in the UK. And he said, when he came to speak with us here about all the good work we were doing before the digital age, he said, look, media literacy and access to media and seeing yourself in media is a basic human right. And what he meant by that was, it really almost doesn't matter only in this day and age what you think about yourself. It matters how other people are telling the story about you and how other people are reacting to that presentation and framing of you. So, you know, people need to be able to see themselves and their issues beyond how the media frame them. And so the most important worldviews and how we come to define ourselves, they're shaped by mainstream media today. So I think it's very true that media literacy and media representation are basic human rights, because without them, as Bill was suggesting, it really almost doesn't matter what your cause is or what you care about or what you think of yourself if other people don't know about that. Now, social media is exciting because for once now, you have people at the grassroots level who can share their stories and leverage the distributive nature of social media in ways that they couldn't before in broadcast. So with that possibility comes a responsibility to teach people, community organizers, activists, people involved in all sorts of social justice causes, students as well, how to use these effectively to get their story out there, to do it in a way that will break through the clutter and will remind people at times when the media are not covering things, such as the Occupy Wall Street movement, you know, how can they get their stories out there to break through the corporate media blockade? The hashtag Bring Back Our Girls campaign, a same kind of illustrative example of how there was a global outcry about the abduction of these nearly 300 Nigerian schoolgirls, and the media talked about it, as they often do, for a few days, and then that was it. So I think it's really important, as Bill was suggesting, that media literacy be tied to social justice initiatives so that people learn how to leverage the power that comes from getting your story out there, sharing it, and having people, they call it now Twitter diplomacy or hashtag diplomacy, to create communities so that people who are like you can validate your stories and get them out there and share them and make sure people are paying attention.
Julie, October 22nd is the anniversary of the death of Andy Lopez here in California. It was a young 13-year-old who was gunned down by sheriffs in Sonoma County for carrying a plastic toy rifle. And that's also the day, national day, of police killings being notified. And, of course, Black Lives Matter is very part of that. Last year on the anniversary, we had a rally on our campus, and speakers, you know, there were a number of speakers and students and faculty that spoke in that. This year, the students are really trying to do a silent rally and develop a meme of understanding with pictures of Andy and pictures of themselves and themes, statements that generates out through social media. Is that the kind of social justice activities you're talking about and using these resources?
Absolutely. So we have the wonderful contribution of Chinjere, Kumanyika, and Paradise Gray in our book. They write about teaching digital literacy and social justice through the One Hood Media Academy that they have in Philadelphia. And so they are proposing what we, of course, would adhere to, which is that you use these tools to get your story out there. And so when I heard Chinjere speak at the Union for Democratic Communication conference, he actually did exactly what you're talking about. He showed, as part of the Black Lives Matter movement, different groups that were meeting together in honor of those that they lost, the victims to police brutality, and were able to share their stories using these tools so that others would see what was not taking place at the national level. So absolutely, those things are very important. You should know that even here in Worcester, Massachusetts, we joined Worcester State students and students also from Clark University got together and also were very concerned about the level of police brutality that we're seeing and organized things and marched together in solidarity and were able to use different forms of media. So even using something as simple as your cell phone camera to record what's going on and then posting that on whatever platform you wish, that's very important. So yes, media literacy approach should include social justice in whatever ways people define them. It's not that you want to tell students today, these are the issues I find important and that I want to pursue. It's about saying, take a look around you. What issues are the most pervasive ones that disturb you or are upsetting to you that you're not seeing reflected in the mainstream media? And then teaching them to use these tools to go ahead and tackle them and bring greater awareness to them.
That's the voice of Julie Frechette. We're talking about media literacy education today in the Project Centered Show. She's at Worcester University in Massachusetts. We're also joined by Bill Usman, who's Director of the Graduate Program in Media Literacy and Digital Culture, Sacred Heart University, Connecticut. And we are all actually with Project Censored and with ACME, Action Coalition Media Education, Sacred Heart University. We've put together an educator's resource guide. So a lot of the things that we're talking about, particularly bringing the real world and the classroom together, you know, a lot of these kind of assignment ideas and so forth, they're all in this resource guide. So I just wanted to reiterate that if there are educators in the audience, they could contact projectcensored.org. They can contact contact Acme, smartmediaeducation.net, or they can contact Bill Usman or Lori Bendig at Sacred Heart University. That's sacredheart.edu/MLDC. This is something that we're really all about here is media literacy education. And you heard earlier that no matter what your primary areas of interest or concern are, if somewhere on the radar, first, second, isn't media democracy, there's going to be problems communicating that. So, Bill Usman, let's shift a little bit back to our attention to the real world again, right? And civic engagement, corporate media. I know that we often slip into the language of mainstream media, and we use the term mainstream. Project Censor, we really try to not use the term mainstream a lot. We use the term corporate media because we find it to be more apt or descriptive. But the term mainstream is actually a propagandistic coup of the corporate media because the implication is that the corporate media represents the mainstream of Americans, just like politicians allege that they represent mainstream culture, right? When in fact they represent the 1% in Wall Street culture. But that's framing, right? And it's a really important concept that we all talk about. Let's take a look at some more framing here from recent events, just because I think, again, I think it happens so often that people don't look. It's, again, one of those looking behind the curtains issues, right? It's sort of the looking behind, well, why is this happening? Why are these things being said? We saw Anderson Cooper at CNN in the Democratic debate posing illegal CIA wars. You know, in other words, you're an unelectable person, right, if you oppose these. He was referring to Nicaragua at the time. No mention that Cooper interned at the CIA once upon a time in college there, but that we'll leave that aside. Operation Mockingbird, perhaps. But the point is that many people just sort of take this stuff in, right? And these frames leave perceptions in the minds of the public that in many cases are just wholly inaccurate, right? So, Bill Usman, let's talk a little bit more about that issue and that problem of framing. How do you deal with that in the program?
One of the ways that we approach media education, our graduate program, is we really look at it holistically. In other words, there are some forms of media education which focus only on media content. And media content is really important. It is behind those frames, you know, that you mentioned. How is language being used? How are images being used to tell one version of a story rather than another version of a story? We know that for every story there are multiple versions, but that those who control the means of production get to control the words that are used, the language, the organizational frames, the images, and that conveys a certain, you know, type of meaning that would be different than the meaning that's conveyed by a different choice of words, just as you just mentioned, you know, like with the language of the mainstream, or different sorts of images. So one of the things that we do in the program is we talk a lot about the deconstruction of visual imagery and the deconstruction of language and discourse to really get into how stories are being told, what perspectives are being shaped. But we also look at it from a holistic point of view, meaning that we can't look at just the content alone. Because the content is not created in a vacuum. The content is not created by, you know, aliens from outer space. The content is created, you know, and when we're talking about the corporate media, by these large-scale, multinational, multi-conglomerate, hyper-commercialized, million-dollar, billion-dollar industries. And it's very important to have that type of institutional analysis as well, to add to the analysis of language and images in order to really fully understand where these messages are coming from, that they're being generated. They're being generated by people with specific agendas, with specific resources behind them, and they're not coming just from nowhere. And then on the other side of it, that these narratives and stories and images have an impact. You know, so also looking at issues of what social impact do media play and how can we understand the way the media environment is influencing how we see the world.
Julie Frechette, again, there's no accidental narrative here, right? And Bill Usman is saying, you know, these are all put out there. Like, things don't just blurt out of Anderson Cooper's mouth or any of these pundits. We could call them, you know, journalists, but we need to understand that the role of these people is to frame this official narrative. Your comments.
Yeah, I would agree wholeheartedly with what Bill was saying and what you're saying as well, Mickey. And it's a point well taken about the corporate media. You're right to say that the mainstream needs to be challenged as an ideology in and of itself. It is a framing device. But I would say, to Bill's point, the three key questions that make a media literacy program effective are the ones he suggested. And I put them in this way. First, you have to ask, who gets to tell the stories of our society? And that's what's going to get you to do institutional analysis. So you'll look at political economy, who owns our media structures and system, and why is it so limited? And then you also have to look at producers, right? Because we know minorities, women, non-whites, and certainly other folks are left out of having a voice when it comes to telling the stories of our culture. The second point you have to bring up is then, how are the stories told? Because more often than not, you find that when someone who's in a position of power tells a story about someone else who they are not a part of that community or culture, oftentimes you see some very interesting power dynamics, such as laughing at somebody as opposed to with somebody. When you laugh with somebody and you're producing a story or narrative where you're one of them, that's a very different position than when you're telling someone else's story and you use very interesting ways of mocking them to make yourself feel more powerful. It's a very interesting hegemonic trick that tends to happen. So getting at textual analysis, like Bill was suggesting, and looking at, as you're suggesting, Mickey, how things are framed, is very important to critical media literacy. And third, you have to ask, how do audiences interpret these messages? So you have to look at audience analysis in terms of understanding how people from different backgrounds, with different perspectives and experiences and educational levels, are going to have different understandings of the same kinds of texts and will respond to them in ways that maybe were unintended. So we don't always take a straight reading. So maybe you're right to say the corporate media work very hard to frame narratives in particular ways. But if we're well educated and if we access other kinds of alternative media, we may have very different ways of then addressing and understanding and challenging those very narratives. We might reject them altogether. And then, of course, comes the essential step that's part of our digital media age today, which is to produce things in light of what's out there, to get your own voice out there, your own perspective, and frame things in a way that would be creative and expressive and better reflect what it is you want out there in the culture and to share it with other people.
And as our friend David Matheson once said, we need to be the media. A good note to end on, right? Citizen journalism, being the media, you know, being active participants in our lives and as educators, you know, really spurring, you know, the next generation, right? Not just spurring them to action, but inviting them, right? Inviting them into the civic stage. Professor Julie Frechette, Professor Bill Usman, thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today. We've been talking about media literacy for the hour, and you're tuned to Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, our engineer, Erica Bridgman. Project Censored Show airs on over 25 stations around the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time. Political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes, while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing, all the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, in the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening, time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love of the brothers and our